This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Krupa Party, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning, and thank you for being with us. Unpaid carers are overwhelmed and under immense pressure. That is the key finding from the latest State of Caring survey from the charity Carers UK, in which 81% of respondents were female. As a result, carers themselves are facing long-term physical and mental health conditions. And we want to talk about that overwhelm. Laura Barnes, who looks after her 100-year-old grandma Joan, will tell us about her experience. But what about yours? If you care for an adult, how do you manage that feeling of being submerged by the needs of someone else, which often leads to the neglect of your own health? What would help you? What do you need? And if you've managed to find reprieve in some form, what worked for you? Do share it with us. You can text the programme. Our number is 84844. All texts will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we are at BBC Women's Hour. You can, of course, email us through our website or send us a WhatsApp audio note using the number 03700 100 444. All of our terms and conditions can be found on our website. And in a minute or so, we'll turn our attention to this morning's news that more than half of all adults and a third of children, teenagers and young adults around the world are predicted to be overweight or obese by 2050. Now, we know it can be tricky to get children and young people to eat the right foods or take on more exercise. And there may be many reasons for that, some more complex than others. You may feel that you are at a loss about what to do. If you're a parent or carer that feels blamed and shamed for the weight of the young people in your lives, or simply helpless about bringing about any kind of change, our conversation will try and guide you through what to do. Also on the show, a possible development in the case of Eleanor Williams, who was jailed in January 2023 for fabricating evidence of a grooming gang in her hometown of Barrow, and the presenter and campaigner Lucy Edwards on her new children's book, all about Ella, a curious, bubbly 12-year-old who has been blind for 2 years and is adjusting to life with the help of her guide dog, Macy. And when the world plunges into darkness, it's up to Ella to save the world. Do stay with us for that. But let us start with that headline that a third of children and young people worldwide will be overweight or obese by 2050. That's according to a new worldwide study reported in the medical journal The Lancet. Rates of obesity and in children and younger teenagers and young adults more than doubled between 1990 and 2021. So if you are worried that your child is overweight or obese, how can you help them? What is the best way to approach this tricky topic without making things worse? Joining me now to talk through all of this are nutritionist and child feeding expert Julia Woolman and child feeding expert and child psychologist Laverne Andropos. Welcome to you both.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Julia, I'll start with you. Now, this report is really presented as a societal issue, but often comes down to individuals. How do you know when a child has a problem with their weight?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me on this morning. It's a pleasure to be here. And I think, as you said, it is a huge, complicated issue. And there's no one reason or, one causative factor for a child being overweight. I think we are seeing, well, I'm certainly seeing so many more parents coming forward who are really worried about their children's weight. Headlines like this today is going to fuel that. But at the same time, they're really conscious about not creating issues and not creating obsessions. And potentially, a lot of parents are very worried about, possibly contributing to disordered eating and eating disorders. So parents are at a real loss. with what to do, and it's very confusing. And what I tend to see is that parents are saying their children are looking bigger than all their friends. So that tends to be something that fuels the concern, is just comparing children. And of course, that's really dangerous in itself on so many levels, because all children are very different and some grow faster than others, especially around the sort of pre-adolescent years. And so that's really dangerous. And that tends to be what fuels it for parents. It might be that their children, they're having to buy their children, you know, their 11-year-old a size 14, 15-year-old school uniform. And that causes the worry when they're buying clothes that are so much bigger. So there's lots of things that can propel a parent's worry and make them think, oh, my child's overweight, I need to do something about it.
Yeah, you rightly point out it is such a delicate balance. Let's bring in child psychologist Laverne Andropis now. Laverne, given all the feedback we're getting from various angles, adverts, schools, medical professionals, all about the images that we should have of our bodies, when it comes to knowing what is right for your child, are parents best placed to judge?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, that is exactly the job of a parent, to know what's best for their child. And I think also to be trying to sort of filter some of these messages for themselves first, so that they've got themselves in a state to be able to talk to their children. I think that, you know, the headlines this morning are alarming, but rightly so, because we want to make sure that we have a generation of young people who are eating well and feeling good about themselves. And I think, as Julia says, you know, there's this sense of, you know, what, I'm going to use the word perfection, looks like, you know, what's the right way to look. And it's very hard, you know, the landscape's quite difficult. You're standing in the playground as a parent, and, you know, you're looking around, and you're sort of always sort of in a sort of judgmental mode almost. But I think that the starting point is, what does your child say about how they feel, how they look, and what they're eating? And I think that's the best place to start.
And if that's our starting point, Julia, because there are health conversations and then there are weight conversations. And again, it's a tricky balance, isn't it? Julia, how do parents navigate that?
It's so tricky. Certainly some of the things that parents come to me saying is, I'm reaching out for help because my child is now coming home from school saying that they're fat, mm-hmm. and someone else, you know, other children are calling them fat. And what do I do about it? And we've got, and it's really hard. I'm a parent myself, and I've been through it myself. It's really hard. And when you're put on the spot, you think, no, darling, you're not fat. You're beautiful and you don't need to worry about it. And so that's sort of one way that parents might approach it, by sort of just sort of brushing it under the carpet and almost complying with the word fat as being a negative thing, when actually fat is actually just a descriptor, just like tall or short. And we all carry fat on our bodies. So partly there's work for parents to do, I think, around trying to neutralize the word fat as a bad thing, because it's just a descriptor. But when it's used in an unhelpful way, when it's used in a bullying way or a negative way, that's when the problems start for children. So, of course, we can't control what happens outside of the home and in the school playground. But in terms of how we use the word fat at home, we can perhaps neutralize it. So we might acknowledge that, that, you know, we have to acknowledge how a child's feeling and perhaps question, you know, what's made you say that? What's going on? How does that make you feel? The other thing that parents might do, the other end of it, is, okay, so you're feeling fat. Let's fix it together. And let's start eating healthier, and let's cut out your snacks, and let's eat a bit less at mealtimes. Mm. And that kind of.
So it's acknowledging that there might be a weight concern there, really, not just brushing it under the carpet and saying, no, you're absolutely fine, which can often be the kind of safe place to head to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Related to that, Laverne, because Julia raises the subject of labels there and, you know, using caution when using labels like fat. Similarly, food, labelling foods as good and bad. How do parents navigate that?
This is a very complicated area, isn't it? Because I think until you're confronted by this, you sort of just get on with it. But I think that it's back to, you know, having conversations about what are we going to eat rather than, you know, getting into the detail. You know, three meals a day. You know, when I've worked with colleagues who, you know, been working with young people who, you know, have fallen into the more difficult side of eating, they stress the importance of having three meals a day and having snacks available and that they're healthy snacks. And how do we get that into the sort of repertoire of what a child feels confident about? Because actually it's about confidence as well. You know, the landscape of eating is so complicated because, you know, I've seen patients who will say, well, you know, well, my friends can eat absolutely everything. And once you get into those sorts of comparisons, you're into a minefield of never quite feeling you're on top of things. So I think it starts at home. I think parents are more than qualified to sort of have a think about, you know, what they're noticing about their child's confidence in relation to eating and the way they look, and to tackle it from that point of view. What are we going to do together? How are we as a family going to really think about how we stay on a sort of steady path? And these are conversations for the parent. This is not what we want to be talking to children about. And you know, when we have those slip-ups, that they are just that. They're not to be agonised over. I think the other thing is that we don't want parents to overly sort of commit to this idea of the ideal, you know, what their children should be doing and should be looking like. This is an individual project, really, for you and your child as to what works well for you and what you're noticing about your child's eating habits. We don't want children slipping into the sort of comfort eating, suppressing emotions and anxieties through those sorts of avenues. And parents are, as I've always believed, best placed to notice these things and to put in sort of remedies.
There are two areas that I want to get into whilst we have you both. One is exercise and the other is judgment, because it's hard to talk about a child's weight without mentioning exercise. It goes hand in hand with diet. And Julia, we know that for some kids, exercise doesn't come naturally to all children, or they haven't found their sport yet. I mean, what do you do as a parent in that situation where you've tried Saturday karate, you've tried football club, you've tried everything, but you just can't find their happy place?
Yeah, absolutely. Not all children are destined for sports and team sports. And yeah, it's not all about that. Absolutely. And in fact, you know, sort of national guidelines are not exercise guidelines, they're physical activity guidelines. So it is just about being active. And what would be ideal is for parents to find something that the family enjoys doing together. It might be, you know, going to the local park on the weekend, or, you know, with lighter evenings, going for a little walk together. But what I'm really, really keen for parents to kind of take away is not to be doing this kind of physical activity with their child to lose weight, not to burn up calories, not to make them less fat, just because it's an enjoyable thing to do. And I think we have to kind of build this kind of physical activity into family life, especially if a child isn't a sporty child. You know, as I said, finding activities, finding something that everybody enjoys doing together, or even just one adult with the child going for a walk or whatever, but just because it's a nice way to spend time together. So I'm really conscious that we're not encouraging children to be active, to do exercise, to lose weight, because that starts the whole kind of disordered way of thinking around food and bodies and making ourselves bigger and smaller through exercise and what we eat.
And Julia, just staying with you on the subject of diet, what are the foods that should absolutely be on the menu?
Oh, well, if only it was that simple. I don't come from a school of thought of good and bad foods and foods that we must eat and foods that we mustn't eat. So rather than highlight specific foods, I'm going to just say variety. Variety of all the across all the food groups is what we have to aim for. So that means including your starchy carbohydrate foods every day and every meal. Those are what gives us, especially children, energy. You know, bread, cereals, pasta, rice, grains, or that, you know, those sorts of foods. Of course, we've got fruit and vegetables, and those come in a food group together. And then we've got our sort of meat and fish and eggs and sort of largely known as protein foods, but really those sorts of foods. And then we've got our milk and dairy foods, you know, yogurts, cheese, milk. So we've got sort of four main food groups there, and really we want to see those all incorporated into a child's daily eating patterns, if possible. Some children are quite picky eaters, so rather than again focus on the perfect eating plan per day, thinking about it across a week can also be helpful. So yeah, it's not as easy as just sort of saying this food and that food.
That's clear. Good to get that advice. And Laverne, just before I let you go as well, the subject of judgment, because sometimes parents, carers, we might be saying the right things to our children, but it might be the uncle, the aunt, the grandma, the neighbour who comes in and says something that can be quite damaging. I mean, what do you do in that situation?
I think you have to be very, very clear-minded about this. I mean, we are really challenged by wanting to get the right messages across. And actually, these judgments come from so many different places and are so unpredictable. I would be saying it's not helpful. It's really not helpful to be speaking in this way. You know, growing children need to feel appreciated for just that fact, that they're growing up in a context where food, exercise, all of the elements of being a young person are contributing to their well-being. And I think by focusing on just one area really skews the picture, you know, in terms of appearance. So I think it comes from you as a parent. I think there are lots of parental traps to thinking your child has got to look a certain way. And actually, I think you have to sort of almost reset and think, what's good for me and my family? And I'm absolutely with Julia about the we. This is a we. It's not about putting all of the attention on a young person, because they can't do it on their own. They're not in charge of these really important fat features of family life, of making meals. It's a parent who really is at the helm, and it's for that person or two parents to really focus on what's good for our child and what can we provide, and to do the best job they can.
Really good to get the advice from both of you, Julia Woolman and Laverne Andrebus. Thank you both for your time. And if you'd like to read more about that report from The Lancet, do pop along to BBC News Online. That's over on our health pages. In 2023, Eleanor Williams, aged 22, was jailed for 8.5 years after being found guilty of lying about being raped and trafficked by an Asian grooming gang and for fabricating evidence against him. It was in relation to her now infamous Facebook post showing bruising, later found to be injuries she inflicted on herself. At the time, the photos went viral, leading to a solidarity campaign, Justice for Ellie, and also to a backlash with crimes committed against Asian men in Barrow-in-Furness, where she lived. She was subsequently convicted of perverting the course of justice. And now, in an unrelated case, three brothers have been convicted of abusing girls in the Barrow and Leeds area. One of the men is mentioned frequently in Eleanor's diary. This story has always been very complex, and to explain these new developments, here with me is Liz Lane, a specialist producer from Sky News, who's been closely following the story. Welcome.
Hi.
Now, before we get into the latest developments, I did touch on it there in my introduction, but please do take us back and explain the background to this case for those who haven't been following it.
Yeah, so Eleanor Williams is a young girl, well, she was a young girl, age 19, when in May 2020, she posted on Facebook saying that she had been the victim of an Asian grooming gang, and she posted some photos of horrific injuries that she said she'd sustained at the hands of these men. And within an hour of her putting that post up, she was arrested, because actually behind the scenes for a while, in fact, for about a year, almost a year, the police had been investigating her because they suspected she was making false claims and actually fabricating evidence to back up these claims. So she was arrested. And as you say, in early 2023, she was jailed for 8.5 years for perverting the course of justice in relation to allegations against five men, which were proven to have been lies, and that she'd faked evidence to back them up, and quite, you know, went to quite extreme lengths, and including, they said, and was found by the jury to be correct, that she'd inflicted severe injuries upon herself. But as you say, very recently now, there has been a development in the case in that these three brothers who were convicted at Preston Crown Court just over a week ago, two of those brothers were actually also accused by Eleanor Williams of being her alleged abusers. They were names that came up during her trial as other men, and she was never actually charged with lying about them. And these brothers are brothers originally from Leeds, and they're called Shah Jaman Mir, known as Sarge, Shahar Amran Mir, known as Jay, and Shahar Alman Mir. And Sarge and Jay are the two brothers that she had also accused of abuse.
And just to be clear, do these convictions have any bearing on Eleanor Williams' her story specifically?
Well, no, they're totally separate in that. I mean, so these brothers, what they've been convicted of are historical offences. So between 1996 and 2010 in Leeds and in Barrow, and some of their victims were as young as seven, really horrific crimes. The two brothers were given life sentences, but the police say their offending then stopped in 2010. Eleanor Williams' allegations in Barrow began from 2012. So they're not connected in that way, no.
But you highlight that one of the individuals was named in her diary. How can we be sure that Eleanor didn't fabricate her diary?
Well, we can't. You know, we do know that she fabricated evidence. And in fact, the judge said during her trial that diaries were, you know, part of the evidence that she had fabricated. We do know these particular extracts we have, though, were contemporaneous. They were written at the time they're dated because we've got the metadata. So we know that. And Sarge isn't the only person that she's named in this diary that has gone on to be convicted of sexual crimes. There's actually another man who, 2 years after she wrote that, and after her mum had actually been emailing the police about concerns about both this man and Sarge, broke into a woman's house in another town and sexually assaulted her, and he was jailed for that. So it does raise some questions as how she was naming these men who at that point, so at the point of her writing this diary, neither she nor the brothers nor this other man had been charged with anything. So, you know, she had their names on her radar, though.
Sure. But as you say, it does raise questions, but it's important to stress, isn't it, that this doesn't change anything regarding her conviction for perverting the course of justice in those faked Facebook photos.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, you know, her convictions were against telling lies about five other men. And we're not in any way suggesting that, you know, she didn't do that. She did. You know, she's found guilty of that. These are other men. And in fact, at her trial, the prosecution barrister said, even if you believe she may have been the victim of something, it's not a defence for her having told lies.
In terms of kind of gathering the information that you've managed to get so far, we know that Eleanor was released from prison last October under the early release scheme, having served 40% of her sentence. And we know that speaking to the press would have breached the conditions of her release. So how have you been able to gather this information?
Well, we've worked on this story now. I mean, I've been on this story since 2021, and I've known about this man Sarge since then, actually through another case of another allegation in a different town in Hull. So we've been gathering evidence for a long time, and obviously we weren't able to report on his case until his conviction. We haven't been in contact with Ellie. We can't, because that would be in breach of her license conditions. And in fact, she didn't even know that we were going to be doing this latest episode, which we put out of our podcast, Unreliable Witness. So, you know, we can't contact her because that would be in breach of her license conditions. But, you know, we've spoken to very many people in Barrow, previously spoken to her family, colleagues, friends, and, you know, very much to the men she falsely accused as well. We've spoken to the police. We've tried to speak to all sides to give a as balanced and, you know, true a picture as we can possibly tell.
And specifically, you have spoken to Eleanor's mum?
Yes, on a number of occasions before we have, yes.
Yes. You mentioned victims there, because I do want to talk about the consequences this case has had for those who were victims as a result of her lies. At her trial, the judge concluded that the consequences of her lies for the criminal justice system were far-reaching, adding, there is a risk that genuine victims will be reluctant as a result of this to come forward. I mean, what can you tell us about this? Has there been any evidence of this so far?
I'd say even in this historical case, we interviewed one of the witnesses, and she was also found to be a victim of intimidation by the three brothers, or one of the brothers. And she spoke of how, when the whole Ellen Williams case became public and they started to hear about what had happened, in fact, one of the victims in that trial almost pulled out because they felt, well, we're going to be thought of as liars now. So it actually had a very significant impact on how they were feeling. But this witness, Elizabeth, says, you know, Barrow was branded to be a town of liars, and we're not all liars. You know, grooming was happening here. And we know more widely because we've, my colleague Jason Farrell and I, who I did this podcast with, we've spoken to victims of these kind of sexual exploitation around the country. And, you know, after the Ellen Williams verdict, they were very concerned about, you know, how it might impact on them, because we know trying to get a result in these kind of cases or any kind of convictions extremely difficult as it is.
In the same vein, as a result of Eleanor's Facebook posts, crimes were committed against Asian men, some of whom were assaulted, their businesses and their reputations were harmed, some even had to go into hiding. Do you fear another backlash from your investigations?
Well, as I say, we've tried to speak to all sides at all times. And in fact, for this latest episode of the podcast, we went back to Mo Rami, who's the guy who was centrally at the centre of her false allegations. So he was one of her victims. And we've spoken to him about this to get his reaction. In fact, he knew this guy, Sarge, because he worked for him and lived in one of his flats. And he says he's, you know, as shocked and horrified as anyone else. And also in terms of a potential backlash, the people that we're saying that she named are actually all in prison. So we're not suggesting that there's anyone else kind of out there that, you know, which it's very specific about these three individuals.
Liz Lane, thank you for joining us. Liz Lane and her colleague Jason Farrells.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, here to tell you that my podcast, Dear Daughter, is back. And this time, I'm joined by an all-star lineup of guests, each with some sage life advice and a letter for their daughter.
Every mother has a letter in her head for their daughter. So it's really nice that that's being like expressed out loud.
That's Dear Daughter stars from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
This recent update on this story can be found in the podcast series Unreliable Witness from Sky News. Thank you for joining us here on Women's Hour. There are currently 5.8 million unpaid carers in the UK, according to census data, and the vast majority of them are female. The latest State of Caring survey from the charity Carers UK has found that more than half of them feel overwhelmed, with an increasing number of experiencing poor mental health because they cannot take a break from caring for either a disabled, older or ill relative. As life expectancy increases and people are living longer, the number of hours of unpaid care has increased over the past 10 years. To discuss this, I am joined now by Helen Walker, CEO of Carers UK, and Laura Barnes, who at 37, alongside a full-time job, also cares full-time for her 100-year-old grandmother, Joan, in Rochdale. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Laura, I'm going to start with you. You have been Grandma Joan's full-time unpaid carer for 5 years now. Just tell us a bit about her. She turned 100 recently, didn't she?
Yes. Hi, thanks for having me. Yes, she turned 100 in February, so she's just getting over the fuss. She's all right.
A milestone indeed.
Yeah.
And how did you end up becoming her carer?
It was a complete accident. So I was working in London, like most 30-somethings, and we were working from home just before the start of the pandemic when we weren't too sure what it was. And I was asked by my father to go up to help look after my grandmother. And so I wheeled my little suitcase out of my flat and I said to my flatmate, don't worry, you'll just be for 2 weeks. And that was 5 years ago.
Goodness me. So from a little suitcase, accident. You've moved in.
Completely, because it became apparent. I mean, it was just before the national lockdown. So after lockdown, it sort of became apparent that she couldn't live on her own. She was, I think, I don't know, a mere 97 at that point, or a mere 96. And it was just apparent that she couldn't live on her own. And so it sort of dawned on me that we were going to have to do something. And then that's sort of the long discovery that I sort of became an unpaid carer.
And Laura, I know she's strong in mind, which is wonderful to hear, but there are physical challenges.
Of course.
Just talk us through those.
So she has macular degeneration, which basically means she's blind, and she's in heart failure as well. So there's, you know, the care is quite intense in terms of, you know, personal care, intimate care, medication, and sort of mobility in general. What that means for me is that I sort of can't really leave the house for more than a few hours at a time. But, you know, we manage the as best we can.
Now, you sound incredibly positive, but this has all happened to you in your 30s, mm-hmm. When, you know, you should be focusing attention on career and still socialising, as we all should. Yeah. But, you know, it's an interesting time for you. And here you are, housebound in many ways, looking after your grandma. It's important for you to highlight to us just what those challenges have been for you personally and professionally.
Yeah, I think that's sort of part of the main point. I mean, caring has taken everything from me apart from my job. And I'm very grateful that I have a job that I can work remotely from. I'm a comms person for a tech company. I can do that remotely and I work, you know, 14 hours a day and I care. And that is it, really. There's no life. I guess I have an existence. There's no joy. There's no hobbies. There's no going out. There's no friends. There's no relationships. And yeah, I'm 37. So I think that timeline probably doesn't help me in terms of having a family of my own. And I think as a woman, it's particularly important to highlight, because career-wise, the fact that I have to be remote does limit my employability. And it's remote not by choice, by obligation. And, you know, there's sort of this, you know, the majority of carers in the UK are women. And so you are expected almost societally to, oh, well, you'll provide the care, especially if you are, you know, in a traditional family setup. Who looks after the in-laws when they get older? It's the wife, usually, both sets. And sort of there's that sort of societal bias against women who will just sort of, oh, yeah, you'll just provide unpaid care and you will suffer effectively in your own life.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. We will return to some of the points that you've made. Do stay with us. I want to bring Helen into this conversation. A couple of lines there from Laura that I've just picked out there. Caring has taken everything from me and I have simply an existence. You must hear these things all the time, I imagine.
Unfortunately, yes. It's a very familiar story. People get completely consumed by caring. And I think Laura's quite you know, lucky in that she said she's able to juggle work and care. Many people aren't able to do that. In fact, 600 people a day give up work in order to care. And so the pressure on them and the pressure on their mental health is huge, because as she says, you care and you work and that's it.
Talk us through the latest numbers, this latest research.
Well, the latest research is that the number of carers who are presenting with serious mental health issues has gone up. So from 27% to 35% presenting with bad or very bad mental health problems. And that, we believe, is mostly because of the lack of breaks. So you should be entitled to a carer's assessment. Well, you are entitled to a carer's assessment. You should be entitled.
Which is what exactly?
Which is you can go to your local authority and ask to be assessed in terms of the amount of care that you provide and whether or not you're allowed to have some support, some social care coming in to provide that break for you. Should be entitled to a break. And so many people are not getting breaks. Now, there's lots of reasons for that. We all know the pressure that local authorities are under. We know the financial pressure that they're under. We all know the challenges with social care. So social care at the moment is underfunded. It's crumbling. Many respite centres didn't reopen post-COVID. And if they did, they didn't reopen at the same levels. So often it's just simply not available. So people are telling us that they haven't had a break for several years. They haven't been able to go out and do their own thing for a long time. And that then has a massive impact on their mental health. They're also worrying about their finances. And again, another impact. If you're juggling, you know, can I afford to eat? Can I keep the property heated at the same level that it needs to be for the person that I care for? This last couple of weeks, you know, I don't know, we've all had, you know, your utility bills will be going up by X percent on the 1st of April. All of us have those. Carer's allowance, the lowest benefit of its type, is £81.90. That is going up by less than the cost of a first class stamp. It's going up to £83.29. That's not going to cover those those bills that are increasing. And so that then has a further impact on people's mental well-being, their anxieties about how they're going to cope, how they're going to be able to keep on caring for this person. So it's a huge issue.
It's a maze. It's an absolute maze. Let me put that back to you, Laura. So we talked about carers' assessments there. Have you had one at all?
No, I haven't had one for the simple reason that it would take a very long time. And when you're 100, you don't really
bureaucracy.
Have a huge amount of time. And I would, quote unquote, earn too much, I think, to be entitled to anything because I work. And so they will probably just tell me, well, you know, you're fine. Get on with it. We don't, you know, we can't help you. And to Helen's point, they're underfunded. So even if they wanted to provide help, a lot of the times they can't. They simply do not have the funding because it's just not a priority for government.
That's very true. And I mean, this government has announced a review of social care by Baroness Louise Casey. I think what we would say is whilst we welcome that and it's needed, I mean, there's no shadow of a doubt that it is needed. The first report, it won't start until April this year. The first report will be in 2026 as an interim report. The final report won't be until 2028. So we won't see any fundamental change in social care during that time. And we saw, last week, the paid carers coming onto Westminster and marching to say that the impact that the increase in national insurance has had on providers of social care is really tipping them over the edge. So we all know local authorities are going bust. Yeah. So it is an absolute minefield in terms of the finances, in terms of the support that is out there and available to you, even if you're entitled to it.
You mentioned the government response. Let me just expand on that. A government spokesperson said, we want to ensure families receive the support they need, which is why we are increasing the carers' allowance earnings threshold by around an additional £2,000 a year, the biggest rise since it was introduced back in 1976. The Better Care Fund, backed by £9 million, includes funding that can be used for unpaid carer support, such as short breaks and respite services. We're also making available up to £3.7 billion extra for local authorities with social care responsibility in 2025 to 2026. So lots of commitments, lots of money coming their way. But as you said, it takes time for that all to trickle down and make a practical difference. Let me bring in a few comments that we've had from our listeners. Linda in Newark says, I am a full-time carer for my physically disabled husband post-spinal surgery and hip replacement. What would help me is for my husband to have residential physio for 1 to 2 weeks so I could have a welcome holiday. Don't get me wrong, church, family, volunteering, interacting with those friends once a month and meeting old school friends intermittently is a great help. Thank you for your message, Linda. And this one from R in Birmingham says, I'm a full-time carer to my son who has learning disabilities. I've never had a carer's assessment and no respite from the local authority. I've managed with the support of local charities. Financially, I have no savings as I can't work, no pension, and I worry that I've let down my other children as I spend all my time caring for their brother. Carers are not valued and there needs to be a societal shift in attitudes towards us. Thank you both for your messages. Now, you know, what I'm hearing from both of those messages, and I'll put this to you both, is guilt. I mean, Laura, I'll put this to you. You are clearly doing so much for your grandmother, but do you have to navigate those feelings of guilt?
Yes. I mean, I think you navigate them. And I would say specifically in the UK, because if it relates to social care, there is it's underpinned by guilt and shame. And I'm half French. And I think in the French social care system, which is light years ahead, it's not perfect, but it is light years ahead of the UK. It's not underpinned by the economic value you bring to society that dictates your value as a human, which I think in the UK, there is that level. As it relates, you know, depends what you read. We're either benefit scroungers who get prosecuted by the DWP or we're heroes. Mm. I'm neither. I'm just an exhausted version of everybody in the UK who will become unpaid carers at some point in their life. The feelings I have guilt. Am I doing enough? And mainly stress, actually, of sort of, I need to be on this call, but I have to give grandma lunch, but I've got to give her a shower. Has this prescription come? Why can't I get a visit from the GP? It's sort of mainly stress, if I'm honest, and guilt that I'm not a doctor. And so when there's a symptom flare up of heart failure, I don't know what's going on. Even though I've had 5 years of on-the-job training, as it were, I still don't, you know, I'm still guessing.
Can I ask you a question, Laura? When was the last time you had a break and what did you do in it?
Oh, God. I can't remember. I don't know. Okay, I went to the hairdresser maybe like a year ago. I can't remember. I don't know.
There you have it. Helen, what do you say to people who are desperate for more help, can't wait for these funds to trickle down for that to even happen? What do you say to them? What can they do to help themselves or seek help now?
Well, they are entitled to a carers assessment, so their local authority has to provide that. So if they're looking for help, if they're looking for advice, I'd advise them to go to the Carers UK website, because there is a wealth of advice of what their entitlements are. They can email in to our advice line or telephone our advice line as well and get a bespoke advice as to what they're entitled to. But just to Laura's point, you know, the value of care, unpaid care in this country, is £184 billion. That's the equivalent to a second NHS. If carers stopped caring tomorrow, the health and social care system would crumble. So the NHS 10-year plan and the new social care review by Baroness Casey have to have carers through them like a stick of rock, or they will fail.
Thank you so much both for your time. Helen Walker there, CEO of Carers UK, and Laura Barnes, who cares for her grandmother Joan. We wish you all the very best. And if you've been impacted by anything you've heard in this discussion, you can go to the BBC Action Line, where you'll find links to support there. Thank you both for joining us here on Women's Hour. I was talking a moment ago about the case of Eleanor Williams back in 2023, who was jailed for 8.5 years after being found guilty of lying about being raped and trafficked by an Asian grooming gang. And speaking to Liz Lane from Sky News Podcasts about a development in that case. In relation to that, we've had these statements from the Cumbria Police, who say all of Eleanor's allegations, including those emailed by her mother, were investigated thoroughly and there was no evidence of any involvement by the Mia brothers. And regarding the previous allegations, they also said this is not a case where there has not been enough evidence to pursue what she was reporting, but a case where allegations were proved to be lies, with evidence fabricated in an attempt to support those lies, resulting in convictions for multiple offences of perverting the course of justice. So those statements that we've had in from the Cumbria Police on that story. The football, the body that governs the Football Women's Super League is now considering the idea of suspending relegation. Now, that means no team would be demoted, and this is in order to give time for the league to expand from 12 to 16 teams. Lots to talk through now with Susie Rack, a football writer at The Guardian and author of A Woman's Game. Welcome, Susie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us more about how the league works currently.
So at the moment, it's very similar to the men's Premier League in that, you know, you have relegation and promotion, that there are three or four teams that dominate at the top of the table with the biggest investment. It's quite difficult for teams coming into the league because of the sort of, you know, how few professional teams there are and how little investment there is across the entire pyramid for teams to come up and compete in the Women's Super League and stay in it, in the same way that you might get teams in the Premier League staying up, because the gap between them is far, far bigger in the women's game. But at the moment, it operates on sort of that fundamental principle of English football, that you have relegation and promotion, that anyone in theory, can progress up the table and could win the Women's Super League.
OK, so what's been put on the table now, potentially?
So basically, the WPOL, which is the body that was running the Women's Super League and Women's Championship, split off from the FA in the summer, set up as an independent company because the FA couldn't really kind of run it anymore, taking it as far as it could go, couldn't invest enough compared to, you know, all the other commitments it has into, you know, disability football and things like that. So basically, which represent all the clubs in the league, met on Friday to discuss proposals to basically scrap relegation for 4 seasons at least. There's no guarantee it would be returned after that, in a view of expanding the league, which is only 12 teams at the moment, up to 16 teams. So the idea is over a 4-year period, you would add one team promoted from the Championship into the top flight and you wouldn't have relegation, so that that league was expanded to 16 teams. Now, obviously, that's controversial because scrapping relegation, a fundamental principle of the game, is a huge move to make. And, you know, there's a lot of a let off in there for clubs that don't invest. You know, they've got a safety net there, they're guaranteed to stay in the league. You know, there's no incentive to invest to stay competitive and ensure you kind of keep yourself in the division. So yeah, hugely controversial plan, and only come out sort of through leaks and, you know, sources in the meetings and things like that. You know, nothing said publicly about this proposal that's on the table yet.
And what do those who support the deal say?
So the argument is that it will encourage investment, right? So, you know, you close off relegation, the teams are guaranteed their safety, and so then they feel capable of investing in the game without fear of going down and being impacted financially and then, you know, kind of having to claw their way back up again. But, I mean, I think we've seen a lot of evidence to suggest that that doesn't necessarily work. Manchester United were sort of allowed to apply for a licence and join in from the Championship and skip the rest of the pyramid in 2019. And West Ham similarly were able to jump into the Women's Super League and not sort of earn promotion through it. And that hasn't prompted them to invest significantly. If anything, they're chronically underinvested in teams relative to the size of the club you've got. So that argument doesn't really hold much weight. And instead, you're really kind of putting a big barrier on teams coming up. You know, you could go for quite feasibly, if you're trying to grow the size of the league, 2 promoted, 1 relegated, and grow it that way. And then you've still got that competitive element and you maintain the threat of relegation as a real prospect that holds that that position. The feeling is that they look at the NWSL in America, which is a closed league, and think that is a way to go and a potential setup. But the whole structure of football in America is so different to the sort of pyramid structure we've got here. So it doesn't really fit. And yeah, it is very worrying for a number of fans and stakeholders invested in the development and growth of women's football.
Thank you so much, Susie. That's really helpful just to get that summary from you about that development, that potential development in women's football in the Women's Super League. Thanks for joining us, a football writer from The Guardian, Susie Ratt there. Good to have you with us here on Women's Hour. Next, Ella Jones versus the Sun Stealer is the first children's book by the presenter and campaigner Lucy Edwards. You may be familiar with Lucy from her social media accounts, where she's built up a huge following, sharing her life as a blind woman online. Lucy's lustrous red locks also feature on the Pantene shampoo advert, and she's recently been announced as an ambassador for the Royal National Institute for the Blind. And her new book follows 12-year-old Ella, whose lack of sight gives her the upper hand when the world goes dark after a vengeful god wreaks havoc on the world. I'm delighted to say Lucy is with me here in the studio now. Hi, Lucy.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's wonderful to have you with us. Now, you have had this idea in your head for many years. Tell us where it all started.
Yes. So For me, I absolutely had no representation of blindness, like authentic representation, when I was a little girl. Going blind when I was 17, but also having a visual impairment basically all my childhood, you know, I would look to different books and stories and on telly, online, and there'd be nothing. So I was kind of scared to be blind when I eventually lost my eyesight. So for me, Ella Jones is just, you know, the quote unquote normal. I don't really like using the word normal, but she's just an amazing kid that is resilient and all of these different things. She doesn't have any superpowers. So, you know, the trope of, I guess, you know, we've got lovely Daredevil. I absolutely adore Daredevil as like a franchise and series. But I think, you know, it becomes problematic when that is the only representation. And for me, it's not authentic, you know, to my experience, because I don't have supersonic hearing. But so when we follow Ella, you know, she is a 12-year-old girl who's lost her vision, but the world around her is the thing that needs fixing. And that's what I always say, because I believe in the social model of disability. And she's so confident. Like, I wish I had Ella's confidence.
Well, I feel like you do. How much is Ella's character based on you?
So much. I've got all of my like 29-year-old wisdom and shoved it into her, really. Like, I would have wanted to be her when I was younger. And, you know, through her friendship with her sister Poppy, which is very much based on me and my sister, there's only 15 months between us, and she got me through so much of my sight loss journey. We're so close, and that's why I always say I love blindness, because, you know, it's given me wings and given me my voice and a purpose. And that's, you know, what we want in life, isn't it, as humans, is to have a purpose to push us forward. And, you know, we see her best friend Finn and also her guide dog, Miss Maisie, who's based on my gorgeous guide dog who's at my feet now, Miss Molly. So, yeah, it's very lovely.
That. As you say, there are so many layers to Ella as a character. She also teaches us, both young and old, a great deal throughout the book. And you do hear about how she's adapted to life living with her blindness. I love, for example, how she chooses her outfits each day. Can you just explain this?
Yeah, of course. So she, like me, labels her outfits. And I just wanted this to just be a very, like, again, normal part of her life, because it is just every day. For me, blindness isn't scary. It's not something that I want fixing. It's just something that is just my day to day. Like, I've lived it for 12 years now. So for her, she labels her clothes, and she, you know, has this pen that she like hovers over on her hanger, and it details what outfit she's wearing. She uses also a colour detector, which is what I do. Tools and technology is amazing when you have a disability.
Yeah, the other thing that stood out for me about Ella, the character, and I wonder how much, again, this relates to your personality, is how she chooses to respond to people who might say or do the wrong things when it comes to visually impaired people or their guide dogs. Mm. She chooses to respond calmly and in a constructive way to what she calls their ignorance.
Yeah, I think that for me was something that I've really had to work on. I remember, you know, even now I get guide dog refusals, taxi refusals, and it's a massive thing. If you speak to any guide dog user, you know, we have to face this. And I remember when I used to get in a taxi when I was 19, I would feel distraught and it would wreck my whole week, you know, having refusals like that. And quite rightly, you know, I was only just going through it, and I would be like, oh, you know, that person only sees my guide dog and not me. However, you know, through going through this and being able to, I always say I don't give people the key to my mind anymore, and it's you know, I've had to work in therapy with that. But you know, that's what I wanted to come across with Ella. Like, she is so resilient and kind of takes it on the chin, and that's something special.
Don't give people the key to your mind. I absolutely love that. Empowering people is something that you are so passionate about, and you often do this through the videos that you share online about your activism, your broader work. And you've also shared videos of yourself doing beauty for years, and it's something that people might not expect when it comes to a blind content creator. Why is that important to you?
So important, because beauty isn't just what we see, it's what is within. I always preach that. And you know, beauty for me was rehabilitation. When I lost my eyesight, I couldn't look in the mirror and I was distraught. I always loved makeup, and that was my sense of self. I didn't want to lose myself. And I thought, oh, well, you know, the world has kind of shut me out. Like, I'd walk into supermarkets and still do, and every bottle, every product feels the same. And I think that's why, like, displaying Ella's world, you know, making the world dark for everybody else, really does show that her friends and family have to rely on her and how resilient she is. And, you know, I've done the same with my own family, like in real life, and it really shocked them that, you know, I do just navigate this life with grace eventually. You know, obviously I've had my hurdles, but I think, yeah, beauty is just so important to me. And I think, you know, doing my makeup is just the routine that I needed to kind of tell myself that I am enough just the way I am, and I don't need to be fixed, and I'm not a burden, and all of these different words that I used to feel about myself. It was like the ritual of like feeling okay again. Yeah, so I just developed that, and I love beauty.
But you don't just share the day-to-day things. You also share kind of more complex, multi-layered things, profound personal matters like your IVF journey online. Why was it important for you to be so open about that?
Because we don't see blind moms at all, you know. And also, for years, I've shared, well, probably like 6 months to a year now, I've shared that I'm losing weight for IVF and having that journey. You know, I haven't seen that represented. But also, you know, the comments that I would get underneath that would then be filtered by the social media platforms would say, you're not going to be a good mother, you know, you will choke your baby, and all of these different things that I won't repeat because they're probably too bad to repeat. But, you know, I just block them, I move on, and I don't want that to be someone else's reality in 10, 15 years when they're having a baby and they happen to have you know, sight loss. So this is what drives me forward. Like, I can take these comments. I've been blind for 12 years. I know what social media is like. And, you know, this is not going to stop me being a mom, an amazing mom, a mom that's independent. You know, we're going to be learning skills on how to get Miss Molly up the road with a lovely pram and a sling and all of these different things that's to come this year. And I know I've got to do some training on it, but, you know, we've got to make these things more publicly available if we're going to see the representation that we need. There's so many amazing blind mothers out there that are thriving and that are amazing, and we just need to keep shouting about it.
Lucy, your energy is so contagious, I have to say.
Thank you.
look, there's a favourite video of mine that I do want to highlight. It's from your wedding day.
Yes!
And on your wedding day, you asked that all of your guests and your husband be blindfolded when you entered. Why was that important to you?
Super important. I think I always dreaded walking down the aisle on my wedding day as a blind person, and I didn't want to dread it anymore. I actually walked down the aisle to the song Arrival of the Birds by the Cinematic Orchestra. Mm. And it was a song featured on The Theory of Everything by Stephen Hawking. It's my favourite film, where it's this montage of his life as he acquires his disability. And this is what disability is for me. It was the worst moment of my life, but the best moment of my life. And I wanted to reflect everything that I've been through when walking down the aisle. And I think just blindfolding someone, yes, you know, people would say possibly, you know, oh my gosh, it's only giving them a snapshot, but it allows someone who's never been through blindness to draw from that personal experience they have from that moment. And yes, maybe, you know, it kind of makes people scared, possibly. That's how I felt on the first moments of my blindness. Obviously, now I'm not scared of blindness, but it allowed people to really get inside my mind. And also, it allowed my husband to just say, you know, it's okay to be blind, and I love Lucy's reality, and we live this together. And I don't place, you know, a lot of emphasis on visuals. Like, my husband is a visual effects artist. Like, he runs my companies with me, but he wanted to experience my dress for the first time, as I did, you know, because he values that more than anything, my experience. And it's so refreshing, like, having that perspective. I think that's what's made me feel so independent, and people coming away from it is just amazing. And we also had Navilens codes all around my wedding, which is also on the front of my book. And a Navilens code is something that you can triangulate to. It's a code that you can print on anything. You've probably seen them in Euston Station. They're on so many products these days, as well as the front of my book. And it's like a different type of QR code that blind people can scan, that is full of geometric shapes, and your phone can just triangulate and find it easier, because I've struggled to find barcodes. Mm. And yeah, you can find it with 3D audio, which allows me to navigate to things, including my book, which we had all around my wedding as well.
What do you want people to take away from this? Because I know it's aimed at kind of 9 to 12 year olds, and I will be putting it on my daughter's bedside table as well. But adults can read this too. There's so much to take away. What do you want people to take away from this?
That disability is just a part of life. We're all big blobs that just live on this planet. And, you know, I happened to lose my vision through no fault of my own. I didn't know necessarily it was going to happen when it did. And I'm still Lucy. Ella Jones is still Ella. She's an amazing girl. What I'm really excited about is that, you know, this is also in Braille. The RNIB have been paramount in this journey with Ella Jones. Like, they've really supported us. And I think, you know, my why, the reason that I get up every morning is to say to all of those little Lucys out there, you are amazing.
And we'll have to leave it there. You are amazing is a note we will end on. Thank you for listening
to
Woman's Hour.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. There's plenty more from Woman's Hour over at BBC Sounds.
This is Danny Robbins here, host of Uncanny, with some exciting news to share. The Uncannyverse is getting even bigger with a brand new Uncanny TV series on BBC Two and iPlayer, featuring some frankly terrifying cases that will make your hair stand on end. But then we will be taking an even deeper dive into these stories with Uncanny Postmortem, a new visualised podcast, straight afterwards on BBC Two, iPlayer, and right here as audio on BBC Sounds. Expect spine-tingling new twists and some chilling revelations. That is Uncanny Postmortem. Join me, if you dare.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, here to tell you that my podcast, Dear Daughter, is back. And this time, I'm joined by an all-star lineup of guests, each with some sage life advice and a letter for their daughter.
Every mother has a letter in her head for their daughter. So it's really nice that that's being like expressed out loud.
That's Dear Daughter Stars from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter,